So indeed, I will be talking about our recent archive submission, A Convergent Inflation Hierarchy for Quantum Causal Structures. And yeah, we have been working on this problem for a while indeed. And yeah, we're happy that you're excited to hear about it. So let's go through a quick outline of what the talk will be about. The start will just be like the problem description and why we actually care about this problem. And then quite quickly we'll transition into like what's been done before, and in particular inflation and NPO and stuff like that. So sort of the tactics of how to solve this problem, how to tackle it. And it turns out we will need what's known as a De Finetti theorem, which will relate symmetry to independence. And then the next step is to actually have like the new type of inflation hierarchy that we proposed, and also show that this one is convergent. And that will already be sort of going toward the end of the talk, and I will end with some conclusions and some open questions. But first, let's motivate why we care about the problem. And it's an age-old question of correlation versus causation. Finding correlations is often not super hard. You can look at a probability distribution, and there are quite a lot of measures of, you know, finding out whether variables are correlated with each other. But finding out whether, say, A causes B or B causes A, or maybe there is some underlying cause that causes both of them, that's actually a very non-trivial question, and yet, of course, quite important. So the question is, can we deduce some sort of causal structure just by looking at the observed statistics? So if we have a probability distribution, can we actually find out which variable causes which, or like which underlying variables might exist? And this has many applications, in particular in medicine, economics, and many fields of study that have to do with statistics in general, and in particular, of course, also physics. And like an important example that we deal with, like maybe on a daily basis for some of us, is like Bell scenarios, Bell tests, stuff like that. But actually in economics, it turns out to be very important as well, because only this year, like only a few months back, half of the Nobel Prize in economics was given to Engrist and Imbens, as it says, for their methodological contribution to the analysis of causal relationships. Now, their research had more to do with the instrumental scenario, but still it was very much related to this question of causality. And so this, I think, underlines the importance of this topic, that like the Nobel Committee also thinks this is important. Okay, so what do we want to answer? Well, suppose we have a causal structure, and we have an example here given by the triangle scenario. We want to find out whether a certain probability distribution over observable variables is sort of compatible with this causal structure. So how should these things be read? On the left, we have a classical version, and we have these squared nodes, A, B, and C. And those are the nodes that are actually observable. So for those, we have like a probability distribution, a joint probability distribution. And then there are these circled variables, X, Y, and Z, and they are unobservable or latent. And we don't know anything about them. Like they can be infinite dimensional. We don't know their dimension. We know basically nothing. And the generalization to like a quantum causal structure would be to make these unobservable nodes quantum, the quantum systems. Again, these quantum systems could also just be any dimension, even infinite dimensional. And so in the classical case, we kind of know how to classify the probability distributions for the triangle scenario, because it would look something like this. So it looks already a bit complicated, but at least we can classify it like this. And as you can see, A is only influenced by X and Z, which is what the arrows indicate. B is only influenced by X and Y. And C is only influenced by Y and Z. And X, Y, and Z among themselves are independent of each other. Right? So there's really sort of a splitting in which of the variables causes which of the observable ones. Now, as an example of something that cannot be produced in the triangle scenario, we have what's known as the GHZ distribution. And suppose we only have like binary outcomes on each of the nodes, on each of the observable nodes. And the bits are perfectly correlated. So they're either all zero or all one with probability 1/2. And this cannot be produced in the triangle scenario, not in the classical case and not even in the quantum case. And I mean, you can look at it for a bit and realize why this is the case. It's basically because these underlying unobservable variables cannot really talk to each other, right? So they have some independence and therefore they cannot do this perfect correlation. And so the difference between classical and quantum causal structures is that for the quantum causal structure, you need to do measurements of these quantum systems, right? So if we talk about Alice, Bob, and Charlie, as we like to do in the quantum case, then Alice needs to do a measurement, a joint measurement on the part from row AB that is sent to her and the part from row CA that is sent to her. And then this will give you your probability distribution. Okay, so the question we want to answer now is this. Suppose we are given a causal structure and a probability distribution, then we want to approximate this probability distribution like arbitrarily closely by a probability distribution that can be produced in a quantum description of the causal structure. We want to get like arbitrarily close. And the question is, can we do this? Can we find such a probability distribution? And sort of the main result of our article is that, yes, in fact, you can do this. So the result is this, there is a hierarchy of semi-definite programming relaxations for this specific problem, which is complete in the sense that it can detect any incompatible distribution with measurement operators of a given Schmidt rank R. Now, I will tell you more about the Schmidt rank R later, because it will be an important parameter for our hierarchy. But what should also be noted is that every compatible P can, in the end, be arbitrarily well approximated by a finite Schmidt rank model. So for some R, eventually you will capture everything in your model. Okay, any questions so far about the problem description? By the way, if there are questions at any point, just unmute yourself and ask them. I'd be happy to answer them.
Do you have any bounds on how fast? How fast goes the convergence with R?
No, we don't have those. So that will be one of the open questions at the end that we are still interested in, whether we can find something like that. Yeah. All right, so let's go to the next slide then. So how to tackle this problem? Well, the first point to think about is that this is actually quite a difficult thing. So if you look at the references that are on this slide, it happened all in the last few years, like a lot of the progress happened in the last few years. So what has been done? Well, for a long time, it was unclear what to do at all and whether the question was even decidable. And then like in 2019, some people in this Zoom meeting came up with the inflation technique, which is a technique to relate like symmetry and independence. I will go into more detail in a few slides. But they use this to, in the end, find a complete hierarchy of linear programs for the classical case of this question. And like this was of course a big result. And it was only in 2020 that this was published. Now, the natural thing to do, of course, is to like generalize this to a quantum inflation technique. But the question remained open whether this hierarchy, this inflation technique, was also convergent in the same sense. So what is this inflation technique and how do we do it? Well, first we have to know what we mean by causal compatibility. So given a probability distribution, we want to know, are there POVMs given by EAs, FBs, and GCs during this talk? And is there a state row, which is splitting up into like three parts, A, B, B, C, and C, A, such that the probability can be reproduced by like applying this state to these POVMs, or the other way around. And so the problem is that we need to describe this independence of the state in terms of a product state, but the set of product states is actually very tricky to handle. And so one of the reasons for that is because it's not a convex set, for example. So how to deal with this independence and how to deal with product states is actually a very difficult question. And so sort of the idea of the inflation technique is to relax this to something that has something with, that has to do with symmetries. And symmetries are much, much easier to deal with because, first of all, these independence relations imply those symmetries. And secondly, symmetry is a linear constraint. So linear constraints are, of course, much, much easier to deal with. And this is made precise in the inflation technique. So whenever P is compatible, there exists an inflated causal structure, which has n copies of the latent system. So on the left, we have an example with just like one additional copy, so two copies of each state. And then for each of those copies, there exists like n squared copies of the POVMs, right? Because if we look, for example, at Alice's laboratory, then from the left, we have n copies coming in, and from the right, we have n copies coming in, and they have like n squared possible combinations of making measurements of like what comes in from the left and what comes in from the right. Okay, and then this will give us a certain permutation symmetry. So I've written it down in equation form, but it's always easier to look at it vectorially. So suppose we start with sort of the triangle coming from all of the first copies, and this should be the same as if we sort of swapped like the top one. So see the difference between the first and the second case. So swapping that because they're identical copies should not change the outcome of this measurement, right? And basically this holds for sort of any permutation that you can do of these three parts, right? So if you would have n copies, then you can do like any symmetry from Sn on all three of these parts. And now the question becomes, for this relaxation, can we now decide whether we can find a certain probability distribution in this quantum description? And the answer to that turns out to be yes. And the way we can do this is with non-commutative polynomial optimization, which is a whole mouthful, but basically what it says is we have a hierarchy of semi-definite programs. And what the hierarchy does, it takes as an input for the triangle scenario, the probability distribution PABC and the inflation level N. And what it spits out are sort of these, that there exists these operators, these POVM elements, and a state rho on their algebra, such that it gives you the state that the state has permutation invariance over N levels of the inflation and a probability distribution row that is produced by this state row. Okay, but the important thing to note is that this state row is like a global state and it does not have this invariance, right? Not yet, at least. So this is what we're after in the end. So the next step is we have a permutation invariant state by this MPO. But what we want is that rho factorizes across these sort of three partitions.
Yeah, Lawrence, is this like a theoretical result about semi-definite programming? Because the ones that I'm familiar with, I don't know if they recover the POVM and the states. They just sort of tell you whether or not, like if they existed, then.
Right, so then... it depends a bit, I'd say. So there is this, I think there's this rank loop trick where at some point, like if there is a rank loop, then you can actually construct them. In the general case, not so much. Indeed, you just show that there exists states and POVM elements such that it holds. But that is enough for this case, right? Because the question is indeed, does it exist? And I mean, it would be cool if we could also actually find them, but for now, the question is just whether it exists or not. Indeed. Yeah. All right. So we want that row actually vectorizes, and we're not there yet. So let's take a closer look at what happens, for example, at Alice's laboratory. Because what does this vectorization actually mean? Well, like I said, like part of the state is coming in from the left and part is coming into from the right. And there is some global measurement being made on sort of both of these subsystems coming in from either side. But the vectorization with respect to sort of a splitting over those measurement operators. And that's kind of weird in a way. So what we should have is like algebras, like observable algebras on the left and observable algebras on the right for each of the states coming in. And together they should form like the total algebra on Alice's laboratory. So to be more precise, what we need for this vectorization property is that if we have elements from this algebra on the left and elements from this algebra on the right, then the state should vectorize over those elements. All right. So we have some to-dos now. So the first thing is we need a converging STP hierarchy for quantum problems, but this is actually given to us by NPO. So thanks for that. That helps a lot. And the second thing now is that we need to deduce independence from these symmetry constraints that are given to us by inflation. So for that, we need a fitting Definetti theorem. And it turned out, or at least we didn't know of any Definetti theorem that existed yet that exactly fitted this problem. So so we had to prove our own. So that's part of the results of our paper. And second, and like thirdly, we need to make sure that the quantum model that comes out of NPO is actually such that these observables of Alice, Bob, and Charlie factorize in this left and right way in the first place. And actually, this question turned out to be like harder than we anticipated. In fact, when we started, we didn't anticipate this question at all. But when working on the problem, this is where we got stuck for a long time. So let's go down this list from top to bottom. So the first thing is already done. So let's look at the second one, the fitting the Definetti theorem. So first of all, let's do a quick introduction of what the Definetti theorems normally do. So whenever you have a permutation invariant state, for example, just like k copies of a certain state or like some mixed state over such copies, but we can also have something more difficult, like the GH set state, like the generalized GH set state. This also has a permutation symmetry. Then what happens if you look at certain subsystems, they will all be equally entangled with each other because of this permutation symmetry. And therefore, by the monogamy of entanglement, they all are not very much entangled with each of the subsystems. Right, and this is sort of the property that you leverage in these Definetti theorems. So for example, if you look at K subsystems of this n-fold GH set state, then you trace out the last n minus K. And it turns out that then you will get just the maximally mixed state. And this one is of course not entangled. So this is just an example, but it might give you an idea of how these arguments generally go, namely that this permutation invariance in the end leads to things being separable. And many of these Definetti theorems, many versions exist, but none fit our purpose. And so we kind of had to do our own. So the question is, why don't they fit our purpose if there are already so many? And the reason for that is because there are several models for quantum mechanics, and specifically, we needed the second one. So the first model, which I think most people are most familiar with, is the Hilbert space model. And with this model, you would associate to each subsystem a Hilbert space Hi. And whenever you combine subsystems, you just take the Hilbert space tensor product and sort of be done with it. And then operators on these Hilbert spaces are just embedded into the larger Hilbert space by padding with identities. So this is what most people are used to doing. But then there's this other way, which is maybe also physically motivated in the sense that whenever you have spatially separated measurements, the minimal thing you can ask of it is that they commute. And if we just assume commuting subsystems, then perhaps we should not impose this Hilbert space tensor product structure. So instead, what we do, you start from the observable algebras. So with each subsystem, you associate such an observable algebra. And then when you combine them, the joint system, it will be a larger algebra, say A12, which has these A1 and A2, so these subalgebras as commuting subalgebras. And for a long time, it was a question whether these two models were actually different. This was known as Tirlson's problem. And only very recently, also like last year, it turned out that these two descriptions are not the same. And in particular, for infinite dimensional systems, it turns out that you can produce statistics in the second model that you cannot produce in the first. And so they are indeed like actually different. So this paper, this MIP star equal to RE paper, I think many people have heard of or have seen, and hardly anybody probably understands, including me. I also don't understand the actual paper, but this is where it actually comes out. So this is where it's actually important. And because our model is naturally the second model, we also need a De Finetti theorem that fits this second model. And as far as we knew, this didn't exist yet. So I'm going to flash the De Finetti theorem quite quickly. It's not, so it's a bit technical. And the only point that should be taken away from it is that the symmetry constraints indeed in the limit give you a separable state. But for those people who are already like quite familiar with the De Finetti theorems, what we did is we showed that it also holds for the maximal tensor product of C star algebras. And yeah, this difference between maximal and minimal tensor product is again exactly sort of has to do with this difference between Hilbert space tensor products and this algebraic commuting algebra model. And so, yeah, we had to sort of extend this theorem that was already known to the maximal tensor product case. Okay, so that was the second point on our to-do list, and now we have that. And so we can transition to the third one. We need to make sure that the quantum model is actually such that the observables factorize in the right way. So from the original inflation, we get the following. We get POVMs, or for every sort of level of the inflation, we get a permutation invariant rho. But what we want is that whenever we have these left and right algebras on each of Alice, Bob's, and Charlie's subsystems, we want the state to factorize in the following way. So whenever you have this global state and all these operators from all of these subalgebras, we need the right side of C and the left side of A together, and the right side of R and the left side of B, and then the right side of B and the left side of C. And so the state should factorize in the way that's written in this slide. So let me pause here for a second, because this is quite important. And if there are any questions at this point, feel free to ask. Okay, otherwise I will continue. Because getting here is actually not so trivial, because the independence property here is defined in terms of observables that are not actually being measured. We only have these EAs and FBs and GCs in the original model. And the local operators, they do not clearly come out of the original inflation model. And so this was what we struggled with for a long time, trying to find these sort of local subalgebras. And in the paper, we also give an example of why it might be very difficult to actually find those just out of the operators EA, FB, and GC. So instead, we make a modification to the model. We ask NPO to instead find the generators EIL, EJR, and okay, these generators have a lot of indices. I will discuss all the indices in a moment. But they come from this left and right algebras, and they should combine into these measurement operators, EIJA. Okay, so in the end, like linear combinations of products of these operators from the left and right algebras should combine into EIJA. And in fact, this is always possible for some R if P is compatible, because AL and AR are dense in the total algebra AIJ. So there should exist some R, possibly infinite, such that you can write EIJA in this way. So now let's focus a bit on what all these indices mean. So if we look at the first term, at ELIA alpha, the L stands for the left side. The I on top is like the ith copy that is coming in from the left side, the ith copy of row CA, so to say. The A is the measurement outcome, which was also associated to like this capital E I J A. And finally, alpha is sort of the term, which term in this sum we are talking about. So alpha runs from 1 to R, and R is what we call like a Schmidt rank operators. And R will also be a new parameter for our model. So like I said, in principle, in order to capture any possible operator, any possible measurement, you need to let R go to infinity. Now, of course, in your computer model, you cannot do that immediately or at all, actually. So R becomes a parameter, and you start from very low values of R and slowly crank it up to higher values. All right. So again, let me pause a moment on this slide, because this decomposition of EIJA is the main difference between our inflation model and like the original inflation model. So we ask the computer for these generators, these ELIA alpha and these EJRA alpha, instead of the actual POVM elements. So that's the important distinction. Okay, so what happens then? We have the third point, because now we actually have these left and right models, and we can do the factorization because we put them in by hand. And so the third point is also done. So now we can actually do like the convergence argument. So if NPO succeeds for level N, we know that there exists a state rho, which is indeed symmetric over all permutations of N copies. Right? This is what NPO gives us. And then the de Finetti argument will give us that if this is true for every N up to infinity, then there also exists, so at first it gives us a separable state, but with some additional tricks, we can also show that there exists a product state that actually produces this probability distribution PABC with these measurement operators EA11, FB11, and GC11. So So that was exactly what we were after. And finally, we are guaranteed to solve the approximate causal compatibility problem for any epsilon if you crank up the value of R high enough. So of course, like, let me get to a remark on this. Oh, sorry, yeah, one more point. If NPO returns infeasible for a given R and any value of N, then you can conclude that there exists no quantum model of that causal structure with measurement operators of Schmidt rank R that produces P. Right, so this is sort of the statement that was already known about these inflation techniques, that whenever it doesn't work, you can exclude P. Now, in our case, you can exclude P for a given rank R, and then increasing R high enough, you can do it for any R. Okay, but a few remarks, because there is a price to pay. The first obvious price is that we have an additional parameter R, which actually increases the number of generators you have to input into your STP program. So that is an expensive parameter to add. But of course, the positive side is that now we can actually show convergence. The second thing there, the second price we have to pay is that the convergence for increasing values of R and N is actually not monotonous. The opposite statement though is that given Schmidt rank R, the convergence is monotonous with N. So if you fix R, then we actually do approach it from below. And as R goes to infinity, like I said, the hierarchy jerks everything in the end. So that was our goal for this paper. And that was also what we were able to prove. Okay, so let's go to some conclusions. So the summary of what we've done. So we started by describing causal structures in terms of commuting algebras. And then we needed a certain Definetti theorem in order to sort of go from symmetry constraints back to independence. So showing that these relaxations in the end also imply independence. And finally, we needed to show that there exists a converging STP hierarchy for the causal compatibility problem. And basically combining all the steps in the presentation, that was the end result. Now there are still some open particular, like Miguel already asked, are there bounds or scaling with R? That would be an interesting question, but at this point we don't know yet how to do that. Then secondly, are there maybe other ways to identify these local algebras? So we put them in by hand, right? We really put them into the STP. And so of course they came out because we put them in. But maybe there are other ways, maybe there are smarter ways to identify these local algebras. And that also ties into sort of the third point, whether the original hierarchy is also convergent or not, because we have not proven that or disproven that, right? We have redefined we have defined a new kind of inflation hierarchy, but we have no statement yet for the original hierarchy. So that's still an open question and still, of course, an interesting open question. And finally, we could, check how our hierarchy actually performs if you put it into the computer. And we have a master's student who's going to work on that and as his master's thesis. So something along those lines is on the way as well. Okay, so I think that concludes the main portion of this talk. I have some extra slides if there are questions or discussion points. I think for now, I'll leave it at this. So thank you very much for listening.
Thanks a lot. I have one question. So there is a question, which is the problem decidable? So you are given a probability distribution and you want to know if there is a quantum model for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in Bell standard non-locality, like recently it was understood that if you take it in terms of tensor products, then it is not decidable, right?
That's right, yes.
If you understand it in terms of commuting operators, then it is decidable. And this is very easy. You will just use the fact that you have this NPA hierarchy, which will converge from above. And then to converge from below, I guess you just like increase more and more.
Marco, I'm going to stop you. You cannot. Eh? From below, you cannot because you have to consider algebras of infinite dimensions.
Ah, okay.
You can use variational methods when you have the commutators.
Okay. Huh. Well, but then the question is just from above then, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. But so my question is now, so we are quite convinced that if you again take tensor product, it will not be decidable because of course you can just ignore all party except two, right? But now let us take the definition in terms of commuting operators. Do you have proven that the problem is decidable? Because you don't have a true bound from above, right? Because you have this Schmidt-Rank R hypothesis, right? So I have the impression that you have not proven that, but okay, I'm not those decidability problem. I know what it corresponds to, but I'm not used to manipulate it.
Right, so the first point is that indeed for every rank R, it converges, right? I think that point was clear. And then when we let R go to infinity, or like actually at a finite R, we can already solve the approximate problem. I think this is also shown in the paper. And we can actually do this for any epsilon, and even epsilon going to zero. So if you increase R high enough, then you can do this. So if you take all the limits, like limit of R, limit of R, limit of N, then yes, you can actually, like if everything converges at that point, then you can conclude that it's possible to produce PABC.
Maybe I can also give a rephrasing. So indeed, it's true for the for the problem that is not rank constrained, there is not an algorithm that decides one-sided membership. This is not true because we have two different parameters, and for one, namely for this, as we let n and k, the inflation and the NPO parameter go to infinity, we converge from below to the optimal value, and as we let r go to infinity, we approach from above. So there is not absence of the bound that Miguel was asking about and that we don't have and would like to have. Absence of this bound, indeed, the problem is not yet shown to be semi-decidable. But of course, what one could do now is invent a new problem and say, let's define the rank constrained causal compatibility problem. And then this is now semi-decidable if you want. Yeah, but the original one is still open. And if one is very lucky, maybe one can just do a bound of R and epsilon somehow. We haven't thought about it very hard. So it's open, but I'm not convinced at the moment that it's difficult. So maybe, I don't know, tonight we can solve it. Yeah, just by coming up with perturbation bounds. Yeah, there's a few more subtleties about this, and maybe we should wait a bit. But there's actually yet another minor parameter that we didn't mention that plays a similar role to R. It's going to be on the extra slides.
Okay, thanks a lot.
David, you must have a question.
Well, I was just going to remark that I think the way to phrase what you currently know is that you've put it at it's basically the second level of the arithmetic hierarchy. So it's decidable by it's like solving the halting problem for a Turing machine, which has a halting oracle, right?
It's a very cool way of expressing it in a positive way. Yeah, so it's not known to be the second level of the, which is the name?
Arithmetic hierarchy.
Arithmetic hierarchy, there you go. Yep, we should definitely mention that in the paper.
It is now known to be at the second level.
Rob?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Ellie. And thanks for the nice talk. So I was just wondering, could you explain if one wanted to use this approach to rederive the proof that Ellie and Miguel gave of the convergence in the classical case, could you do that? I mean, would there be an analogous Diffinetti theorem for probability distributions or not?
I mean, so in their paper, they also have a Diffinetti theorem already, right?
Sure.
So, but what is the question then, that whether our Diffinetti theorem and our hierarchy also solves the classical case or?
Yeah, to some extent, can you take the logic that you outlined and say, you know, the only like to make this into a classical proof, one merely has to recognize that, you know, like, you know, if I take the quantum states and make them diagonal in some fixed basis, they become probability distributions, similarly with POVMs. But it wasn't clear to me because the Diffinetti theorem for quantum states strikes me as sort of different from the classical Diffinetti theorem in important respects. So I guess I just wondered whether you thought about whether this proof technique includes as a special case the classical proof technique.
I'm not sure. We haven't thought about this too much, I believe. But I feel like it's also maybe a bit too heavy of a machinery for classical case, because we deal with these maximal tensor products, and I don't know, maybe it would in the end like boil down to something easier if you only consider classical inputs, but I'm not sure actually. Maybe David knows. But...
No, I would say exactly the same thing. We have not thought about it, and also the reason is that it feels like complete overkill. I don't know, if you actually look at the proof of this Diffinetti, then the main work is to find some abelian algebra somewhere. And of course, with classical, everything commutes already to begin with. So I don't know, but I don't expect like a very elegant proof of the classical version to come out of that. It's like too big a gun, yeah, for the problem.
Let me mention that I think it'd be useful if you could see a way of subsuming the classical case, simply because then you could start extending into situations where you sort of have hybrid causal structures, where it's not purely classical or purely quantum in the sources, that you need a kind of common language to be able to deal with those cases. So that's sort of the motivation for rethinking the classical case in this framework.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a good point, and I don't know the answer. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
I think in the classical case, probably you would explain the fact that the hidden variables, you can bound the cardinality, right? And then if you impose everything commutes, then probably you can really put a bound, you can upper bound the VR, right? I mean, so of course you have a convergence.
Yes,
sure.
Yeah, of course. I think it will be like a plain Lascelles hierarchy, more or less, so to speak, right? I mean, when you assume that the variables have, the hidden variables have bounded cardinality.
Yeah, I guess that would work. No, if everything is abelian, then of course the proof still works. And then if in addition you have Cara-Theodori, which gives you a bound on the alphabet size, which immediately limits the rank, and then you're done. So this would probably work. Yeah.
Yes. But again, like in practice, of course, like we cannot go much higher than R, maybe equal to 2 and N equal to 2, something like that. So
I guess it was a consistency question. How do the proof themes fit together,
That's
right? But right. Okay. We did also read the classical proof and we enjoyed it very much. And I think, you know, one should just probably read it directly. It's a big a detour to go via maximal tensor products of infinite C star algebras.
Yes.
Yeah. Just to add on this, also in the quantum inflation paper, there was reduction to the linear programming part, right? If I remember it correctly. And I don't expect this to be much more complicated to do. So we have not really worked out the details, but like as Miguel mentioned, then R would be bounded right away, and then you can also take everything commuting. So I don't expect it not to work. I would be very surprised, but maybe that's a good point to check, because if it doesn't work, then that, yeah, that should be very funny.
I wanted to ask, did you think of any physical situation where you can say, ah, clearly in this case, the Smith rank is going to be bounded?
I mean, you know, whenever you have sort of a guarantee of the bounded dimension, for example, of the subsystems, but
So I wanted to follow up on this question of the bounded dimension of the subsystems, because that's what I was thinking as well. So Miguel, you have work for Bell scenarios where there's a variant of the NPAR before bounded dimension of the shared state. So I'm wondering here, could we do a similar thing, which is causal compatibility, quantum causal compatibility, under the restriction of dimension bounds? Can we recover this distribution with this causal structure with these dimension bound constraints? So the nice thing about that is that it gives you the upper bounds on R, and so you can use this, but then I guess you would need also another way of accounting for the bounds in the hyperspace dimension.
Probably use sampling, right? If they combine the hierarchy with sampling, if they don't just consider the space of all possible Mohr matrices, but only the ones that can be generated by d-dimensional matrices, then this converts at least to algebras with the right dimensionality. And probably in this case, probably you can even prove the tensor product. Probably, I don't know. Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, I would also think so. I mean, we have also in there were a few emails about people asking exactly about the logical structure, as the discussion now shows, and now we worked it a bit, and now we define the causal compatibility problem under rank constraint. Now, yeah, and then we say for this we have like an easy monotonously converging hierarchy, and of course you can equally do it under dimension constraints. They are not exactly the same, but they are closely related. And of course, if you have a dimension constraint, then the rank constraint comes for free. This is certainly true, and you could do it for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's a bit ironic, because for the dimension constraints, you had to work hard, or Miguel or these people had to work hard to discover the extra conditions. And here the rank constraint is kind of a nuisance that we want to get rid of, or maybe not, I don't know. It depends on whether you're actually interested in this hypothesis. Yeah. And you're right, of course, as soon as dimensions are finite, you can actually use normal tensor products and stuff. Though there is another remark somewhere here in terms of tensor products. Actually, in the causal compatibility scenario, there are kind of like six different tensor products. No, there are the internal tensor products of all the nodes, and then there are the tensor products between the nodes. Yeah, and the tensor products between the nodes, they can, in principle, be non-minimal. But one can see that the tensor products within the nodes, one can always assume to be minimal. So there's, I don't know whether anything follows from it, but, at least, there are some cuts in this model where normal quantum mechanical techniques from your undergraduate courses actually apply.
I wanted to ask also about the definitive theorem, right? I mean, because I didn't get it from the talk, sorry, whether you invented it or you took it from Werner and this other guy.
Sorry, can you ask the question again?
So what is the, did you get a new definitive theorem or because they also put a reference of an old paper by Werner. So I don't know if you generalized his definitive theorem or I don't know.
Yeah, so we generalized it. So he did it for the minimal tensor products. We generalized it to the maximal tensor products.
There's some product without dimensions or without dimension constraints or something, right?
Exactly. Yes.
Okay.
We still give credit though to these, because we follow the argument very closely.
Yes.
In fact, there's something that bizarre that happened. So we went to the paper and we wrote everything for the max, and it seemed to work out. And then we thought we had generalized a paper by Reinhard Werner. Now, of course, you all know that is not something that actually happens. No, he always writes the last paper on a subject. So we called Reinhard and we couldn't get him to read anything. You can't get Reinhard to read stuff, but we just asked him and you say, do you think it's plausible that it would also work? And he said, yes, it's plausible that it also works for the max tensor product. And the next question is, why didn't you do it when you were young? And he said, oh, we didn't care. So then we felt sufficiently confident that it's actually true. So, but it's new, but it uses their arguments very closely.
I guess you cannot get bounds, right, on the speed of convergence, right? I mean, I guess, or can you?
No. No, absolutely not. No, I mean, absolutely not. It's extremely indirect. It's super elegant, but extremely indirect. Okay. There is no.
Perhaps because these bounds do not exist, right? I mean, it just converges. That's all. You cannot make any promise about the speed.
Absolutely not. I mean, of course, we know that Diffinetti theorems converge very slowly in the worst case. And the worst case being local dimensions, and our local dimensions are always infinite.
Yeah.
So I'm not even sure what kind of statement one could hope for, but also the technique absolutely do not even hint at a conversion speed at all. Yeah, it's very indirect again. Mm.
Okay.
Ram Speckens has a hand raised.
Thanks, Ellie. So I'm wondering if anything in your proof technique would break if instead of considering each local algebra as factorizing, you allowed it to be a direct sum of factors. I don't know enough about this non-commutative hierarchy to say whether that could be made to work or not. But if you could, it feels to me that perhaps you could extend what you've done to say to solve compatibility for example, you know, rather than just the quantum triangle, you could have these bipartite quantum sources and a classical three-way source, right? So you could think of that classical three-way source as controlling which measurement is done at each wing. And so, but it's a classical control. So now the POVMs at each wing would become a direct sum where the sector is essentially that shared classical variable. So it would just change the local algebra into this direct sum of factors. And I'm curious whether that would, the rest of your proof could still go through in that case or not.
Right. I'm not sure about a direct sum. It might very well work, but actually I think we can already sort of generalize to like any causal structure. You can also like just combine everything in one big algebra, right? One big sort of local algebra, and then apply the whole argument again, I think, to...
It's not as simple as just generalizing to arbitrary causal structure, because if I'm not saying let's put in a three-way common source for Alice, Bob, and Charlie that is quantum, because if I did that, then I could get everything. But you know, if you have a three-way source that's classical, and these bipartite sources that are quantum, then you don't have all possible distributions.
I think you do.
That's if you have setting variables as well. Yeah. The triangle is not the case. The example I should be using, but there are like triangle with settings. For example, I can come up with examples where there is still a gap, even though you've allowed this classical shared randomness. So it's not quite the same as just porting to a different causal structure, because now you have to have distinguished those sources that are quantum and those sources that are classical. But when I saw your factorizing algebra, I'm immediately led to think about generalizations to direct sum of factorizing pieces. And so I was curious whether you thought about that at all.
So we haven't, but it shouldn't be difficult. I mean, you can throw in more relations for this local observable algebra. Now I have to think, what are the kind of relations that make it turn into a direct sum? Do you know? You're distracted at the moment. Right. Give me a few minutes maybe to think about it. I think it should not be difficult. No, you can add extra information about these local observable algebras. That should not be difficult. Again, I think the very interesting question is, Ellie said in the beginning, he thought about the problem and didn't get anywhere, and we also didn't get anywhere for a very long time. I think the very interesting question is, do we need to put them in by hand at all? And we have like half a dozen of proposed constructions, how we get them without putting them in by hand, and none of them worked. And then we kind of had a counterexample that is not really a proof, but kind of strongly suggest that everything we try to do would not work. But of course, we don't have a counterexample to the original convergence hypothesis. And this, I think, is also very, very interesting. You know, do we actually, is there some more intelligent way of constructing these objects directly? I don't know that. I would really like to find out.
Yeah, so I guess I want to come back to that and also Rob's point. So in our quantum inflation paper, we did have a little subsection on quantum networks and also shared randomness everywhere. And we considered a modification where for these diagonal operators like the E11, E22, E33 cases, if there is no shared randomness, then if we look at sort of a marginal, an expectation value sort of which is entirely on these diagonal operators, then it becomes a product of the original probabilities. And so in the case of shared randomness, we did not impose that. We only said that if it's the one copy case, the E11, F11, G11, that it's the original one, but that the distribution was symmetric, that it wouldn't necessarily be a product. And that was our way of finding constraints which were consistent with shared randomness. But I think that's not going to work in general. Rob's discussion of the direct sum kind of requires us to have a explicit upper bound on the cardinality of latent variables, which is also frustrating. And to just sort of be clear about like what the challenge cases are, if you think about four parties, Alice, Bob, Charlie, David, with every pair has a quantum source which connects them. So there's, let's say, six different bipartite quantum sources. But there's also every triple is connected by a classical source. So simultaneously, you have six two-way quantum sources, but also four three-way classical sources. This is like a hybrid type of causal structure where, and is there sort of a hierarchy which can cope with that, which can say, okay, this source being quantum, so here's the rules for that. This source is classical, here's the rules for that. And so maybe we can do this just through additional commutativity somewhere, but that's kind of the challenge, I think, where Rob was going with this.
Yeah, this I think is true. No, I mean, if you have some of your local generators also commute amongst themselves so that they are actually abelian, this, of course, you can put in. Of course, you don't want to actually ever implement that on a computer. That's ludicrous, you know, the number of variables you're just putting in. But in principle, I think, I don't see any obstacle why that shouldn't work.
In terms of the question of, do you need to add these subalgebra factors by hand? It does surprise me, because I would have thought that if you have in this limit of infinite n, that you can apply any permutation to the AC source and any permutation to the BC source, then essentially you know that rho AB must be independent of those, because you have this giant copy of the rho BC source, which is internally symmetric, and a giant copy of the rho AC source, which is internally symmetric. And so anything else which is with them must be a product relative to them. And it seems to me like that buys this factorization of the original sources that you're looking for.
I'd be very happy if that were the case. No, I mean, I didn't quite follow, because you were talking about the permutation symmetry of the states, and now we're talking about the algebra, which is a more fundamental object. Yeah, so again, I think the problem is not handling the symmetry of the state. That's what the Diffinetti does, it's fine. But the problem is to actually talk about what the local observable is in the first place. Now, we also try to construct this, you know, because in fact, I don't know whether anybody has actually read this Werner style Diffinetti, but what he does is he takes the non-commuting observables and hits them and constructs directly a commuting algebra out of them. And so we wanted to mimic this. And so, for example, we wanted to do something like, I don't know, start with an operator in E11 and then permute the right-hand side index. Now you have an operator in E12. So take the average of the two. Now permute the right-hand index even further. Now you have an average of three, E11, E12, E13, and permute, and go on to permute like this and hope that somehow it becomes abelian or somehow, you know, it starts commuting with everything on the right-hand side or stuff like this. So these were constructions that we tried a lot. Throw symmetries in there, average, take commutants, intersect, I don't know. And we tried them until we found this really idiotically simple Bell basis example that's in the paper, and it is compatible with all our constructions and does not, and there is no way to get the local algebra in any algebraic way. So then we gave up. So it doesn't, again, it's not a proof, it doesn't work. But it's a bit more than you know, it's an actual hurdle you have to overcome. It's a bit more than just having tried and given up. No, there's actually an obstacle that one has to overcome. And yeah, I think this for me, I think I don't know. I really want, you know, somebody to work that out and tell me what the answer is, because I don't know.
Okay. I have a few more questions, but does anybody else want to interject here? Okay, so then a short question is, in practice, if the operator rank is a nuisance and we're not dealing with a situation where we can confidently say that we're doing causal compatibility relative to the fixed operator rank, it seems to me that this hierarchy has some undesirable features in that if you use a finite R and a finite inflation level, you do not know whether the function you've optimized is above or below its true value. Would you agree with that?
Yep.
All right. I don't suppose there's any thoughts that you have about finding a different, also convergent hierarchy, but where it converges from the same direction everywhere.
I think the most direct route that we haven't tried very hard is to keep the hierarchy as it is and try to bound epsilon and R in terms of each other somehow, you know, somehow. Yeah. I mean, there's many ideas. You can see, I don't know, like you increase R by one and then maybe the value drops, and then maybe you can infer from that that it can't drop more than that amount if you go R up once more or something like this, you know, some data-driven witness that tells you that. And I don't know. If I knew the answer, it would be in the paper. So I don't know the answer.
Right.
But also, it is not something we thought about very hard. Yeah. So in a way, I don't know. In a way, so we have this convergence which is non-monotonous. And when we had it, we thought, okay, now we have to write it up. Otherwise, Lawrence would go mad because he's been like staring at this problem for a year. This direction has not been exhausted. I think it's not clear to me that this is a hard problem now. But obviously, it is the big open problem and the big demerit of the result as it stands, as you say before. Yeah, it's yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So if you wanted to, you could say it really is convergent for the rank constraint causal optimization problem.
Yes.
Yeah, this would be a fair way of expressing it. And if by convergence you mean monotonously convergent, which I guess would be a fair definition. I don't know whether, you know, there's a commonly accepted term. Yeah.
It's valid, it just doesn't converge from any given direction, right?
Yeah. And again, the version we sent around now makes it very, you know, now it's very clearly expressive. And before various people asked us, and it became clear to us also that it is important and not, you know, not well presented. And so that is something that will be very different in the second version.
Okay. In this talk, you didn't focus much on the operator rank, the C parameter.
That's right. Yeah.
Has your thinking sort of evolved that you can bound that?
Well, not yet. I mean, it was mostly like to make the talk not more difficult than it already was. but I have an extra slide on that, so maybe I can go to there. Let's see. To make sure everybody's sort of on the same level. So indeed, so these generators are a priori not automatically bounded, right? So in the original inflation, the sort of POVM constraints automatically give a bound for all the elements of your algebra. But in our case, that's not true. And so we have to put this bound in by hand. And so for now, we just choose some large value C, which is, yeah, it's an inexpensive parameter because it does not introduce any new variables, but it is a parameter still. We think it might be possible to put it to one, but we're not quite sure yet. We have to think a bit harder about this.
I was also wondering whether you could choose one, because it seems to me there's just a question of like, can you express any POVM as a sum of product of positive operators?
Yeah. So right, it seems like it should be possible. So we didn't emphasize here for two reasons. A, it seems like it should be possible. Certainly, like in finite dimension, it always will be. And also, even if it's not possible, you can just set it to a gazillion and it doesn't hurt the theoretical analysis. But I don't know, you know, we just wanted to make, you know, lay the cards on the table. You know, we can't actually prove it. And I think it's maybe not actually a math question, but like a meta mathematical question. It's how you model quantum mechanics. Like a bit, is locality a tensor product or is locality commuting observables? That is not a math question. You know, both are valid frameworks. And so the question is, here's the technical question. It's the following. Is there a way of making sense of the notion of a local quantum system such that in a bipartite systems, there are bounded operators that can be expanded only in terms of unbounded local operators? Yeah, and again, I think once you fix your mathematical model, you can try to answer it. For example, once you say I work in C-star algebras, the answer is yes, you can always do it because you know you assume boundedness. Yeah, but maybe there is another way of phrasing quantum mechanics, you know, that uses von Neumann algebras that are different. I don't know where this is no longer the case. So I think one can't solve this problem by reading math books again, because once you choose your formalization, it's probably easy to decide. But I think one should, you know, ask an experienced old mathematical physicist, you know, is there a sensible way of describing quantum systems such that, you know, you need unbounded local operators to synthesize a bounded global operator? And so I don't know, we'll kind of go.
In particular, you don't necessarily have that C doesn't have to exceed R. Like, it's also not, no.
No. I mean, think in terms of finite versus non-finite. Yeah, again, it could be that there are situations where something infinitely squeezed, I have no idea, you know, some infinitely squeezed operator. I don't know whether it makes sense at all, you know, where again, it's a projection globally, but you can't write it in terms of bounded local operators. Okay, so at some point, again, we want to drive to Hanover and ask Reinhard Werner and see what he says. And then, you know, if he says it's not possible, we take out the assumption from the paper and declare it solved. Yeah, I think it's a modeling problem, not a math problem per se.
Okay. The next question I have is somewhat more technical. So does anyone have a question before I? Yeah.
I do have one, maybe if I may. First of all, I wanted to thank you for the talk and actually to share like Ellie's excitement about this. I was very happy to see this on the archive and it was a very nice surprise that day. So when reading the paper, I had a bit of a trouble. It's my shortcoming, but probably that means that it has an easy answer. When trying to understand this this product structure in the algebra of the measurements, and in trying to understand which kind of measurements could you actually model with this, for example, does this construction of yours can model like entangling measurements, or is it just product measurements, or like maybe convex combination, like combinations of product measurements? Which kind of measurements can you model? Do you have an intuition on that?
So in the end, you can do all kinds of measurements. So if you, it depends on the rank R. So if you let R like go high enough, then you can do any kind of measurement.
Okay. Beautiful.
Yeah, for example, if let's do it concretely in finite dimensions. So let's say a POVM element E is a projection operator onto an entangled state vector. And let's say the entangled state vector has Schmidt rank S, then the rank of the operator as a tensor is S squared. Yeah, so, right. So you can totally do it and you have to square the Hilbert space vector rank in order to get the rank of the operator. So you look at the operator as a tensor and compute its rank. And for finite dimensions, for example, obviously you get everything and you get And the rank is upper bounded by the dimension of the factors, and the factors are now d squared dimensionals because, you know, you talk about the operators. Yeah, but of course, you can capture everything except for if it's infinite dimensional, then you have to work a bit harder. Okay. Yeah, and there's again the theoretical possibility that there are bounded operators that can be written only in terms of unbounded local operators. And if such a thing exists, then you will not find it using our hierarchy. But again, I worry about many things, but this is not something that keeps me awake at night.
Yeah, okay, beautiful. Thank you very much. Nice.
All right. So another question I had was just about a comment towards the end of your paper. So I'm going to just share screen so that we can.
I have to unshare probably, right?
No, I don't need to share screen. It's not. Okay, fine. So this is just a portion of the paper at the end where you discuss causal structures that have multiple layers and possibility of unitaries, controlled unitaries. And then you discuss this possibility of two or more quantum systems coming together to form a non-exogenous quantum system, which is something that we consider here. So this is just an example of a four-party quantum state, which we could then imagine that there are settings and measurements which are applied to this network. And here we would represent this as a unitary, which creates Bob's local system by having sort of two quantum inputs coming from the two sources. And similarly here, whereas this would be sort of a unitary, which is just a local unitary. And in the paper you say, okay, when we have these more difficult causal structures where two or more quantum systems come together, you define several such potentially controlled unitaries, and you specify the subsystems on which they act through commutation relations. And what I don't understand is why you're comfortable saying all unitary commutation relations, but not the same degree of factorizing the unitary into subalgebras, because you factorize the P of the M's into subalgebras. You have this E, which is for Alice, and you accept, you know, you have a rank constraint, and you say, okay, this P of the M operator is a product of these communities. Why do you not say the same thing for unitaries, where you say, okay, no, there's a rank bound on the unitary, and it also is built out of these operators, which are local, and you need to recover those. So I was wondering if you could just comment on why you're treating measurement operators differently and more strictly than you're treating unitaries.
Right. So you could do that. You could also consider them like that. Maybe I haven't thought about it enough, and haven't thought about like all of the causal structures well enough. But I thought it might not be necessary to do that.
So the reason, if it's not, the reason it would be really surprising to me is we could always treat a measurement operator as a measurement in a fixed basis, right? Like we can say that, you know, a measurement operator is always just a computational basis measurement with as many states as there are outcomes. But then prior to that is a quantum channel, which takes whatever quantum system would be going into that lab, and the setting controls the quantum channel, and it takes all of the input quantum states to something which is mapped to this lower dimensional state space, which then undergoes a computational basis measurement. And so you never need to imagine complicated operators if you allow for unitaries instead. You can sort of push the complexity from measurements to the unitaries.
Right. So no, then I think this is probably a flaw in the paper, because the causal structure that I thought about for this specific comment here, I thought they didn't need these unitaries to be split up. But I think probably I didn't consider sort of convoluted enough, so difficult enough causal structures where that would arise. And probably those would exist. And then you would also need to split up these unitaries in the same way, in sort of left and right, or maybe even more subsystems. But yeah, that's actually a good point. And yeah, I should have a look at that more clearly.
Okay, that ends my questions. So I will once again express my appreciation. This is a very exciting result. Thank you so much for sharing with us. And if there are no further questions, we will thank the speakers very much. Thank you, Lawrence. Excellent, very clear presentation. And I'm sure we'll follow up with email. Any questions we have? Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, let me want to say it's a pleasure to present, and thanks to Ellie and to people for being so vocal about liking the results. So I think we're all professionals, it happens to us a million times that we publish a paper, but this particular reception felt very good. So thank you for that.